welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear about a recent art project and contest wherein the city of Yucaipa called out to the community asking for a representation of their favorite place in Yucaipa. We'll have conversation with the Community Services Coordinator for the City of Yucaipa, Margot Mullen. We'll also hear from Sage Foy, a student at Parkview Middle School, and the winner of the contest. Her work is on display in the winter-spring edition of Your Yucaipa Community Services Guide. We're going to start the program talking about acting and the acting world. KPCR's Lillian Vasquez has more.
My guest is author, actor, and coach, Matt Newton. He's written his second book, The No BS Guide to the Acting Biz. Your first book was 10 Steps to Breaking into Acting. You've worked in the entertainment industry for many years at this point in your career. Why teach instead of act?
I was an actor for about 20 years. 15 of that was professional in TV and film, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I lived in L.A. and New York. And I found that right around when I hit 30 years old, that I was craving something more. I had a desire to have more say and help people. And I started coaching friends of mine on the side, and then they started booking a lot of jobs and on camera. And I found that I had a way of getting through to them that simplified the process and demystified the business of acting. And then cut to, I opened up my own studio and wrote a couple of books and get asked to coach on a bunch of TV shows. So this is what I do now. I love it even more than acting, and I love helping people. And I spend about 60 hours a week coaching actors, and am experiencing a joy that I had in spurts as an actor, but feel on a daily basis as a coach.
Well, then I guess you made the right decision.
I did.
In your book, you make it clear that show business is not for sensitive people. Your book is not for sensitive people. So what are you talking about there?
There's a lot of sort of talking around the main issues here as trying to pursue a career in acting. And the main thing is that people need to work hard, work like an athlete, train like an athlete, and have an immense work ethic so that they are ready when the opportunity presents itself. So I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek in the opening introduction to the book, simply because I just want people to understand that I'm trying to bring honesty to this entire process, knowing that there's a lot of different perspectives on breaking in and creating a career for yourself. But, the book is meant to not sugarcoat. It's meant to tell people, like, here's how it works, and you decide based on this information. So, yeah, it's not for sensitive people. It's not for people pleasers. It's for people that want to take their career into their own hands.
You don't sugarcoat it. You really tell it like it is, which is quite entertaining and quite, it really does spell it out. I want to break some things down that I've always been curious about. And if you could, what's the difference between a manager, an agent, and a publicist?
An agent is someone who abides by state laws, can only take 10%, and works tirelessly to get you appointments. They're basically an appointment generator. Mm. A manager, however, can decide their own percentage. Usually it's between 10 and 20%, can work out of their house, tends to have fewer clients, tends to be available for you at all times and sort of oversee your career in the long term, talk to you about headshots, footage for your demo reel, the kind of jobs you're auditioning for, will basically hold your hand a little bit more and help you to get your materials together. And a publicist is basically just about generating attention around whatever jobs you do book. So let's say upcoming arc on a TV show, you have several episodes. The publicist's job is to present you to the media enough beforehand so that articles are coming out when your episodes are airing, therefore generating even more attention to your work.
And by attention, you meaning getting gigs, getting interviews, getting print, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, the thought process is, the more attention you get, the more people are aware of what you're doing, and the more they want to bring you in for auditions.
When people are guests on some of the late night shows, are the actors getting paid? So explain that to me.
So usually a publicist, a good one, especially if you have something coming out in theaters and you have to be somewhat of a name, will pitch you to the different shows. And this has happened with a lot of clients of mine and friends of mine. And let's say, The Late Show with Jimmy Fallon will give you a 5-minute slot. it's definitely not a paid gig. It's the type of thing where it's great attention for you and your film or TV show. So they'll come on and do the 5-minute interview, and sort of everyone knows that it's about plugging your film and also attention for you, and it's kind of a win-win for everybody. It's good for ratings, everything.
Even when you're a Al Pacino or a Robert De Niro, they still have to pitch the idea to see if they get the slot?
That's a great question. You know, some people, like those people you mentioned, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, have personal publicists, but then there's also publicists for the film that they're working on.
I see.
And that film they're working on will be able to generate those interviews, and it's sort of part of the deal. Like, if you're signing on to do a film for a certain studio, you know that you're also signing on to do the talk show circuit, especially if you're someone like Robert De Niro. And that's part of the job.
Right.
And a lot of people will tell you it's an exhausting part of the job. Because, you know, once you've wrapped the film, you know, and then they're starting to prepare to come out in theaters, you basically have to run the course of late night shows and, you know, hope you don't say something wrong. And there's a lot of attention around it, and hope that you feel good about the film enough to talk about it on those late night shows.
Right.
And, you know, you want to feel like it's not a fake publicity kind of thing. You want to feel like it's an authentic interview. And a lot of the talk show hosts and the actors know how to play that game, so it doesn't feel like a total disconnect.
And so, just as long as we're talking about that, don't they also have to have, because some people, let's face it, even though they're actors, they're either shy or they don't have a good story to tell, they're not going to make a good guess. So do they have to pitch an idea of some of the things, quote unquote, they might talk about or they could talk about that might be funny?
Yeah, I think, you know, lesser known actors especially have to be a little bit vetted. So what happens is, and, you know, my sister's an actress, Becky Newton. She's been on a bunch of talk shows. What happens is, the day before, the producer will call the actor and talk to you about the interview and say, hey, do you have any cool stories? And then they'll sort of mention a bunch of stories they might have. And the producer will say, oh, let's do that one. That sounds like a good thing to talk about on this show. So they'll kind of vet it a little bit, basically, so that someone's not just sitting up there, you know, saying nothing and just having a dead interview. So they kind of make sure it's interesting as they can. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. So you'll basically see, you know, when these people sit down on the show and they introduce them, the, you know, someone like the Jimmy Fallon or the David Letterman will say, so I heard this happened to you. You know, they'll be queued up for their story.
Right.
To keep it interesting and alive.
And where I feel that the problem comes with that is, I heard it on Ellen, I heard it on Jimmy Fallon, I heard it on Jimmy Kimmel. It's the same story. So that's why I always think, really? Come on, guys, you got to have a few more stories in your repertoire to tell about your kid or something. All right, let me switch.
Sometimes they don't, and sometimes that's all they got. I mean, there's charisma and there's, you know, not having charisma. And that's a thing. You know, I mentioned that in my book, too. You know, sort of popping off the screen and having, like, sort of off-the-cuff stories to tell and telling in a very natural way. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you'll be locked into the one thing you know how to talk about. And, yeah, I've noticed that, too, and that's really tricky. And it's weird how all this feeds back into people's careers, how, like, being good on the talk show circuit helps you get more jobs. And you hear of people like, you know, Kristen Stewart, who's, like, not great in these things. And people always talk about how not great she is in these interviews. And it affects her in some capacity. You know, it makes people talk about how someone might not be good at interviews. And I think in some weird way, the publicity machine affects whether or not they're getting more jobs.
Now, I cannot imagine that they, and maybe they did, but like when Robin Williams would go on and be a guest, that he would pitch things that he might talk about, because you can never trust where he would go because he was so funny and can talk about anything. So it must, or Billy Crystal, same thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, with that kind of level of celebrity, I think there isn't really much of a vetting process, because they know that just having them on there, they'll be able to riff on whatever.
Right.
And it'll be interesting, and they don't have time to do the pre-appearance interview. So it really depends on the person. I think there's a lot of newer actors who have just gotten a lead on a show who are being pitched to these talk shows who nobody really knows, so they have to kind of make sure that they're going to say something interesting and not just be, you know, dead air.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly. Which is really tough. And I know what it's like to have dead air. Let me switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about casting. And I want to know this. When you see a show like, let's say, Law and Order, and every single person in there that has a speaking line has to be cast?
Yes.
Doesn't that take forever?
It does, and sometimes they have about 30 roles per episode, and that Law & Order is considered episodic television, so every 8 days, roughly, they're casting for the next episode. If you have 20 or 30 roles in the episode, you're basically whittling it down to, you're seeing 10 people per role, so that's, what, 200 people, 300 people over the course of a few days. Then you're showing a smaller amount of those audition tapes to the producers and then bringing back people in person. You know, they have it down to a very fast system. And what's crazy about it is you go in to audition for a role on that show and then the script has changed and suddenly you're thrown into a new scene or a different character and they're like, we just want to see you do this real quick because it shoots tomorrow. So my whole thing with actors is be ready for anything, be adaptable, don't expect things to go perfectly, and then you'll be great at this.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is author and acting coach, Matt Newton. His newest book is The No BS Guide to the Acting Biz. So in general, how many people does it take to shoot a commercial versus a big budget 1 hour drama? I mean, because it seems like a commercial, it's airing for 30 seconds and sometimes it might take just as many people, or give me a little background on that.
Yeah, because you're talking about the difference between shooting a commercial and the crew around it versus a 1 hour drama and the
right.
crew around it.
Correct? Right.
So a commercial might shoot for one day, might be a 15 to 30 second commercial, might have $1 million budget. They might spend all of those 2 days shooting it about 50 different ways on whatever location they decide they want to shoot it at. And then a 1 hour drama has a sound stage. They shoot over 8 to 10 days, might have the same budget, but they have a lot of pages to get through. So it's really about coverage.
Wow.
With a commercial, they just do a lot of coverage. They shoot a lot of different angles. And then in the editing room, they whittle it down to the 15 or 30 seconds that completely sell the product in a short amount of time. And with a 1 hour drama, you know, you only have 3 different shots per scene. You just got to get through all the scenes. So same budget, different amount of days filming, same goal, which is to affect the audience.
Wow. In reading your book and learning about auditioning, it seems like auditioning is pretty important. I've interviewed several people on this show and asking about, you know, how they, you know, people that have been doing it for a long time and what their audition was like, or their first one, or when they applied for a certain role. But what are self-tapes and what's a cry stick?
Self-tape is the new way of sort of auditioning, which is, you know, the person can't be there in the room for whatever reason, or they're under the gun and they have to cast this role really quickly. So they'll put out a request for actors to self-tape, meaning they'll have to send in a tape of the audition from wherever they are, whether they're going into a studio to get it done or they're in their house. Basically, that means actors need to be incredible at self-taping, meaning they know the lighting, the sound, how to execute the tape in a terrific way that's comparable to what's people are experiencing in the room. And the joke about the cry stick, which is a real thing, is that on every TV set or film set, the makeup person has a stick of menthol. And if the scene involves crying, and this has happened to me as an actor, because I can't cry on cue, I would ask for the menthol, the cry stick. And it's a little thing that it looks like lipstick, and they put it under your eyes, and it basically emits a vapor, sort of like Vicks Vapor Rub.
That's cheating.
Stings and hurts and makes you tear up, and it looks like you've been sobbing for days, and it is extremely effective if you can't go to that sad place in your mind, because sometimes there isn't time on a set to wait while you sort of find the sad trigger in your life. And so sometimes you got to bust out the cry stick, and in a self-tape, it can be extremely effective. Extremely effective. But you gotta use it sparingly, because it doesn't always work.
That's cheating.
Yeah, exactly. It's cheating.
Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit to the stage and Broadway. What kind of money do actors make on Broadway and off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway when you're first kind of, you know, making a living, or after you've been well-established and you go back and do a big play and you have a name? Tell me a little bit about the Broadway scene.
Pays less, you know, ensemble players, which is, you know, ensemble in a show like Chorus Line, I believe, you know, and this is all equity stuff and specific equity dues, depending on the length of the run and everything, I think are making about $1,800 a week, and understudies make the same or more if they actually go on, which is crazy. But the leads of Broadway shows, especially people who are somewhat of a name or they're coming from TV, have basically negotiated maybe a percentage of ticket sales as well. So they're making a fee and they're part of the ticket sales, or they have a negotiated flat rate. When it comes to off-Broadway or off-off, you know, those rates are so different. It depends on like the equity contract and whether it's a tour or a certain size theater. And those are very different with each job. Like the huge differences, you know, you do one line on a TV show, you make $1,000 for the day for a couple hours of work. For Broadway, doing 8 shows a week and all those rehearsals, you know, 1800, right, which, you know, still good money, but the amount of work around it is different mediums and different intensity and process and rehearsal process. It just really depends. I mean, I've done a lot of free theater in my time to get to a place where I was ready to be in front of a camera and represented by agents or managers who are getting me in front of the big decision makers, and using all that theater training, even the free stuff, to develop the confidence to be in front of the camera.
Sure.
The confidence to walk into a room of strangers and act like you're on the set of that show is a very tricky thing that comes with lots and lots of experience.
I have so much respect for actors and entertainers, because sometimes when I look at the scenes that they're on, and they're trying to be in that mood, in that character, and you have a camera there, you have the mic dropping down, you have people right around, and the area is so small that you just wonder, how can they possibly be in that mode and carry it on? And then we as viewers can say, wow, look at that. You know, I just have an enormous, I was a theater major, but I hated learning lines. And so I said, no, I'll go backstage and do the marketing or something else. It wasn't my gig.
Absolutely. I mean, learning lines, I mean, with on-camera stuff, it's always the night before. So I'll get 10 emails tonight about people who have a self-tape request that's due, you know, tomorrow at noon. So not only do they have to memorize, but you know, they have to coach it, self-tape it, and it has to seem effortless. And that's the tricky part. You know, with theater, you have, you know, a good rehearsal period. With on-camera stuff, you got to make it look easy in a very, very short amount of time. And that's a big thing that I am coach actors on, is the ability to do that, the ability to fake the confidence.
Now, you say self-tape.
Step on those sets.
You say self-tape, but there is no tape anymore. You're talking they might actually use their phone and record themselves and send them something digitally?
Yeah, it's a dated term, I guess.
Well, I'm old enough to remember it, so.
I am, too.
Okay.
Yeah, they send it digitally. It's a very quick thing. You could shoot it on your phone and send it off in a couple minutes. There's a lot to pay attention to, lighting and sound and making it competitive. But, yeah, basically we have all these tools at our fingertips now. And, you know, it's very important for every actor to be technologically savvy and learn how to edit their own footage, because that's the world we're in. There's over 70 shows casting out of New York, many more in LA, and many more in other markets. And even actors who do a lot of theater are open to doing TV now. A lot of playwrights from theater are coming over to TV and getting staffed in writers' rooms. And so just actors need to be ready for anything. You know, it used to be like TV was lesser than film.
Right.
A film actor, you would never do TV.
Right.
And if you're a theater actor, you would never do TV. But now everyone wants to do everything. It's appealing. It's rewarding. You know, everyone is looking for content and new shows. And so it's really important for actors to understand all the mediums and how to calibrate their acting for the different mediums.
That's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with actor, acting coach, and now author as well, Matt Newton. We'll have more with Newton as KVC Arts continues. Later, we'll hear from Margot Mullen, Community Services Coordinator for the City of Yucaipa. We'll hear about a recent art contest involving places in the City of Yucaipa. We'll also hear from Sage Foy, a student at Parkview Middle School and the winner of the contest. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back to Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Matt Newton, actor and acting coach, and the author of 10 Steps to Breaking into Acting, and recently, the No BS Guide to the Acting Biz.
What I really liked about the book is it was an easy read, and it wasn't, 500 pages long, but it was right to the point and kind of tells someone that really wants to go into this business kind of the ABCs of doing it. When we talk about jobs in the industry, what you're talking about for the most part in your book is acting. There's really so many other jobs too, right? I mean, it's not just acting.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone is interested in writing and directing, even short form content, and producing and wearing many different hats and being involved in all sides of the camera. It's about talent stacking. And I think every actor should, and I mentioned this in the book, be able to handle all different kinds of things, whether it's editing software or understanding how production really works from pre-production to post-production, to what a colorist does, to what a sound mixer does, because it's only going to help you as you move forward in this business that gets more and more conducive to creating your own work. So yeah, absolutely, it's not just about acting anymore. It's about taking the reins and creating a career for yourself and taking all of it into your own hands, which I'm a firm believer in.
I interviewed Anson Williams a couple of weeks ago, and he said that Gary Marshall told them, who is the creator of Happy Days and so many other things, that learn all aspects of it. Don't just be an actor. You'll stay in the business longer if you know more.
That's absolutely 100% true, and it's really up to each actor to make that decision, especially right now when we have all this downtime, to figure out what else they want to be doing, because otherwise you're just simply at the mercy of whether or not people bring you in for auditions. Instead of creating the project, having people submit themselves to you and you being the decision maker on who gets hired for your project. And again, I've done this a few times over, and it makes you a better actor. It makes you a better business person. It makes you have more longevity in your career.
Sure.
And it makes you smarter.
I want to ask about your commercial with McDonald's that you mentioned in the book. Can you share the story and the kind of money that can be made in commercials?
One of the few commercials I ever booked, and I went on hundreds of auditions, and I just was not a commercial guy. My sister was a commercial goddess. She booked everything. I booked nothing except for a few. One of them was a McDonald's commercial. I auditioned for the role of DJ while people were rapping in the commercial. I did not book that job, but I booked that same commercial. And I showed up to set in Central Park. I did not know what role I was doing because no one told me. They told me to bring my own costume. I showed up, and finally, after 8 hours, they said, okay, Matt, you're up. You're paired with this girl. You're going to be sitting out there on the lawn on Sheepshead Meadow. You're just going to be bopping along to the song. I guess the whole commercial was about a song, but I didn't know. So we started doing it. They said action. There's a huge crowd around us. And this director, who already you could tell was a little bit of a diva, yelled cut, looked at me, and he was about 30 yards away, stuck up his middle finger, as if to say, I really hated what you just did. I laughed, thought he was kidding. He wasn't kidding. He hated it. He was kind of a jerk. He, I guess, expected us to do something different, but no one told us what we were supposed to be doing. So he was just really, really unhappy. It was one of those moments where I thought, what am I doing? Why am I being treated like this? Is this what commercial acting is? Is this what the acting business is? But I did not say anything. And I want to say it was 3 weeks later, assuming I'd been cut out of the commercial. They had like 50 different people in the commercial. I got a text from a friend in California that said, are you in a McDonald's commercial? And I said, yes, I was. And they explained it to me, and I said, that's the one. And I started getting checks. And over the course of, I think it was a 2-year period, I made about $50,000.
Oh my gosh.
Doesn't happen anymore. And that was for 1 hour of work where the director stuck up his middle finger at me. I was embarrassed. I was miserable.
But you cashed those checks.
Highest paid gig I've had to date. And the checks would come in and you check your mailbox, there'd be 15 checks in there. One was for $1,000, one's for $10, and they would just all keep adding up, and it came every day. And then the commercial spun off into 4 other commercials, and they re-edited it and sent it again, and it's so crazy. And then you'll do an indie film for a month and get $500 a week and be working 14-hour days and, make nothing. So it's crazy. It's really crazy how this all works, and I think it's important for actors to understand and laugh about it.
Jeez.
And not take it too seriously, which is what the whole point of the book is. And, it's one of the funniest anecdotes I have to date. And, it's funny now, was not funny at the time.
Yeah, but it was easy to cash the checks. How did they know? How did they set it up? How much to pay you or the other persons that were in it? Would you have all gotten paid the same amount?
Yeah,
for that
it's
day?
Like a pre-negotiated SAG rate when it airs on network TV, when it airs during certain shows. It's called, I guess, a wild spot. When it airs on cable TV, there's a buyout. When it airs in like stores, there's a certain buyout for that.
Oh my gosh.
You know, when it's a foreign airing, that's its own fee. So what happens is all those things are acting together, and then every 3 months they start again. So you sort of keep waiting for the commercial to go away, because they usually do, and then this one just stuck around. And so, again, this doesn't happen anymore. You're lucky if it airs for a few weeks right around the Super Bowl, and then it just goes away and you make a couple grand. But this was one of those like monster commercials.
Nice.
And it's crazy. It's really crazy.
Who keeps track of how many? How is the meter keeping track of how many times it airs, whether it's national or local?
That's a whole thing. That's
okay.
Like very official. And actors can now check up on that, because there's always this, you know, mistrust around it. Like, oh, are they sure they're getting all the airings? And I've found old commercials of mine online, and you're supposed to get an online buyout. And I would screenshot it and send it to my agent, and they would call the producer and be like, you're supposed to pay him for this. It's online. And they're like, oh, sorry about that. And they would send a check for $3,000. And, you know, it's so official when it's a union commercial. The thing is the non-union stuff, you know, the buyouts, if you're not in the union, you know, it's like the Wild West. There's no real sense of what the residuals are and what the rates should be. So you're sort of negotiating for yourself. Which is why, you know, once you're in the union, everything's taken care of and you can't skirt the issue.
Wow. We talked a little bit about the internet and how, what I'm assuming, how the business has changed. How has the internet changed the business or social media influencers?
Well, I mean, all anyone really wants right now is to get a commercial cheaply on people's phones, because everyone's sitting around on their phones, especially right now. So it's like, how can you get actors to do it in the cheapest way and as quickly as possible, so that you can put it on all the eyes that are looking at phones. So what's happening is people are doing like a commercial for Facebook or Snapchat, and you know, they're not wanting to pay actors. They don't even want to use union actors. They're trying to do it cheap and not pay residuals. So what it's done is it's, you know, made it difficult for casting directors to make a living. It's, you know, it made union actors consider going non-union. FICOR, giving up their union status, because actors just want to work. They want to get paid. It doesn't matter, for a lot of people I know, if it's a union job or non-union. They just want to work. If it's a commercial for Facebook or it's a McDonald's huge commercial, you know, everyone just wants to be constantly doing something to feel like they're an actor.
Okay, so now I want to talk about credits. Sometimes credits, whether a television or movie, let's stick with television, can go on forever. And sometimes you'll see they'll share titles. And I want to know the difference between an assistant director, a director, and executive producer. Because sometimes you see so many executive producers. Let's just take like Law and Order. Mariska Hargitay is now an executive producer. So there could be five people that are executive producers. So what does executive producer really mean?
So in TV, it's different than film. An executive producer in film, like an indie film, is basically the person with the money.
Okay, funding
it? Like executive produced by, he's the money guy.
Okay.
On TV, it's like kind of the showrunner. Sometimes it's the lead of the show who's been on it forever, who negotiates like, hey, if I'm going to do another season, I want to have this much money and executive producer credit. Does it mean they're heavily involved in that side of it? Not necessarily, but they're allowed to ask for it. You know, they're more the overseeing the show. Maybe they're not there every day. But again, there's executive producer, there's supervising producer. The director of the episode, who's also sometimes, you know, the showrunner, is the person for hire who does, works on all the New York shows, does Law and Order 1 week, Blacklist the next week. You know, they are brought in to continue to maintain the style of the show for that episode. And then the assistant director, which is a little bit of a misleading term. It's much more of a schedule person. The assistant director is the guy on set who says, hurry up, we're losing light, we got to get the shot.
Hmm.
It's not someone who's coming around giving directing notes at all.
Got
which
it.
Is one of the funny things I learned getting on the first set. But yet they're the most important person around, because they keep everyone on track. And not every assistant director turns into a director. So you have assistant director, director, executive producer. And again, on film, all that's different. But what you do see a lot of is associate producer. Now, that credit, which sometimes can be 10 different people, is usually someone just throwing a bone as a favor. So on films, you know, you just hand out, because I've worked on a bunch of films, you just give an associate producer credit to whoever, your friend who had nothing to do with the film. You know, you, those, and you see that a little bit on TV, but TV's much more sort of structured when it comes to that. But I always laugh whenever I see associate producer on anything, because I know that's, you know, not to diminish it, but people really do it, but a little bit of a throwaway thing.
It's a throw-in, really.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So in your book, you asked your colleagues for their best recommendations. So now I'm going to ask you, what is your best advice to someone younger or older who wants to break into this industry, whether it's TV, film, or stage?
It really depends, like, whether or not you're close to or in a major artistic market. So, you know, if you're talking about someone in Idaho who really, really wants to do this, who's young, it's like you do anything. You do community theater. I mean, I grew up in Guilford, Connecticut, in a log cabin, and all we had access to was local shows. And you just do that because you want to do it, and you don't get paid.
Right.
Although I did Sound of Music in the Round in a dinner theater, and I did get paid $20 a show, and it was not a good production. And I felt like a professional actor because I was getting paid to act when I was a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
And you do it because you're building credits and confidence and learning how to entertain people for a couple hours. But if you're in a major market, if you're like new to New York, younger or older, you know, you get into a class and get around people who are doing it, and you ask questions and you do readings and you do short films. You submit yourself for anything through Actors Access, Backstage, Casting Networks, and you build momentum, because you can't just jump into this and then say, well, I want to audition for Blue Bloods. You've got to do the work, like all of us have, and earn the right to be walking into those rooms with big decision makers and potentially book a really big job. But it really comes from, you know, treating this like you're an athlete and putting in the groundwork wherever you are, and deciding at some point, am I going to move to New York, or am I happy here in Idaho doing this work and being a big fish here, or developing my skill set here, or do I want to take this and move it to the next level? And that's the big question everyone has who's serious about doing this.
So we're in Southern California. We're in the Inland Empire region, 60 miles outside of L.A. Do you just have to have a pretty face anymore to be in this acting world?
No, not at all, because the move from, you know, mostly broadcast TV to, like, network TV to cable and to streaming has changed everything. I was telling people today, and I did a seminar, I was talking about John Hamm, the lead of Mad Men.
Right.
You know, he did this famous GQ interview years ago where he said he could not get hired on network TV. He was not considered network TV handsome. Mm-hmm. So people didn't hire him. But then, you know, when Mad Men came along, he just, you know, he landed that role and it became a breakout. And suddenly people were like, God, he's so good looking in this. But he wasn't considered that before. And, you know, the whole thing around shows like, you know, Orange is the New Black that came along and all the streaming content is that there's room for everybody. So it actually almost is a disservice being a pretty face, because it's putting you in a very specific category that people aren't as interested in. Mm. I hate to generalize that, but it's all about hiring people now and not necessarily pretty faces. It's about interesting, unique personalities and faces, and there's room for everybody. And I just see that on a daily basis with breakdowns that are coming out on TV shows. They're not looking for that anymore.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Matt, why did you write this book? And do you live by all the rules and suggestions in it?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I wrote this book because my other one, it had already been 6 years since the second edition of 10 Steps to Breaking into Acting. I had so much more to say. And I felt like the new book would be for people who are at a different level, who wanted to sort of understand the new age of digital and the way, you know, streaming content has taken over and what that meant for auditioning and what it meant for getting representation. And there was so much that had shifted in the importance of social media and the amount of actors who are up for these roles now, and the competition being global instead of just local because they're seeing tapes from anywhere. So I really wanted to go in with the 6 years of teaching experience that I had and lots of experience working on TV shows as a coach, and really bring that knowledge into this book in a very concise way so that I could have anyone who's interested in doing this understand it from the most current trends and not sort of just old school theory, but saying, look, you want to be an actor now, here's how it works, read this, and then make decisions accordingly.
Do you have students that come in, well, not coming in right now, but do you have students or have you had students in the past where you get to know them after a couple of weeks and you think they're never going to make it or immediately think this kid is good for this business?
Even if I think that, I feel a strong responsibility to make them great. And, you know, usually when they're coming to me, it's not just for general acting lessons. It's because they're with an agent and up for a job. So whether or not they're good or not as good, my job is to make them seem great. The problem is if someone who's not great and doesn't have a lot of training suddenly books that job, then they're suddenly thrust into an on-set environment where they have to do it again and again and again, and they haven't learned that. And that's usually when I end up getting hired on the other side of things, when someone who's new or maybe not that great, like suddenly booked a job because they fit perfectly in the show. They're matching a member of a family or something, mm-hmm. or they're the son of someone. So then it becomes my job to make them seem like they've been doing this forever. So yeah, of course that happens, but it's not my job to say you shouldn't do this for a living and crush people's dreams. It's my job to like say, all right, let's figure this out. And I'm pretty good at it. And so are my other teachers. But it's dangerous because we make people seem really great, especially on a tape. And then they really don't necessarily have the technique to back it up.
You know, when I first thought about this interview, I don't know if you're a Friends, if you ever watched Friends, but there's the one episode where Joey is looking for a side gig and he goes in to teach soap opera acting. And he looks at the soap people opera. And go, you guys aren't good looking enough. You'll never get a gig. And somebody else in the class gets a gig against him on All My Children. So I don't
totally.
Know.
And so I was on All My Children, did recurring on that. That was so funny because that's so not about the acting. Like I went on that set. I didn't even know who the director was. I did two episodes. If you sort of get through the scenes and don't really mess it up too much, they're like, okay, we got it. And they do an entire episode in a day, as opposed to in a 1-hour drama, they spend 8 to 10 days doing the episode. So it just shows you how fast they move. Wow. And so I have immense respect for soap opera actors who do it well, because it is hard and there's very little quality control on that set. So it's easy to look bad, but if you're good in that environment, oh man, you look real good.
Soap opera acting is probably a good starting point if you can get that and hopefully move from there. I know a lot of times we'll see so many primetime shows that many of them came from a soap acting gig.
Totally. I mean, that used to be the biggest thing in the world, that was a boot camp for actors. It's just not a thing anymore that anyone, I don't remember the last time someone had an audition for it that I've coached or anyone even talked about it. Half of it's online now, online soap operas. It's a different world.
It's been great talking to you. My guest has been actor, author, and acting coach, Matt Newton. He's written his second book. The book is The No BS Guide to the Acting Biz. Thanks so much for your time, and thanks for sharing and enlightening us on this
Lillian, maybe not awesome, easy business.
Oh,
you're so nice, Lillian. Thank you so much.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with actor, acting coach, and author Matt Newton. We've been hearing mainly about his recent book, The No BS Guide to the Acting Biz. For more information on his classes and coaching, go to mnactingstudio.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Let's go now to a recent art project, which involved a competition, the results of which can be seen in the winter-spring edition of Your Yucaipa Community Services Guide. Once again, here's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez.
My guest is Margo Mullen. She is with the City of Yucaipa. She is the Community Service Coordinator. Welcome, Margo.
Hi. Thank you, Lillian.
So tell me what this project was that was offered to residents in the City of Yucaipa.
So this project, it was a call for middle school artists to submit artwork based on their favorite spot in Yucaipa.
And who came up with the idea, and why was this call for artwork needed?
Our community services team really worked together to create this opportunity for students and for our educators here at our school district. And this really came out of a need from the pandemic for us to be able to offer other opportunities for our community members, and particularly students, a way to connect and utilize art.
When you did the call for artwork, what kind of submissions did you get? What did you see?
Yeah, we received a variety of different artwork from students all over Yucaipa. We had everything from watercolors to graphite drawings to paintings as well, acrylic paintings.
Who judged this? Did you have to pick the winner?
No, thankfully I did not. There were so many great pieces of artwork in this grouping. We were also super excited to be able to partner with the Public Art Committee, and they were the ones that had the tough job and had to go through and evaluate each of the student artwork.
What was the process?
Yes, that is a great question. So we did have a rating card. This was really a guide for our jurors to look at. Some of the ways that they juried this artwork was through originality and quality, artistic ability, theme interpretation, creativity, and the overall design of the piece as well.
All right, so who was named the winner?
A student by the name of Sage won the contest.
And after it was juried, why was Sage selected? What did the jurors say, or what were their comments? Why did hers rise to the top?
Yes, for the work that Sage created, she had a really great composition. The use of colors in her painting, Sage did an acrylic painting, and really what stood out to the judges was that use of the medium, the way that she was able to create that depth and distance that you see in her work, and the variety of colors that she's using to really interpret her favorite spot, which is Hummingbird Hill in Yucaipa.
Oh, very good. And ultimately, how is the artwork going to be used for the city of Yucaipa? What are you planning to do with it?
This was an opportunity for the student. Their artwork is published in our recreation guide. So our community services guide is out right now. And on page 8, you'll see Sage's artwork in the guide.
Page 8, why isn't it on the cover? Well, next time it should be on the cover. Let's work for that.
We'll talk to the designer about that.
As you indicated before, because of COVID, you were trying to tie something in with the students. Is this something you might try again? Is this something that's setting the standards that you're definitely going to do again? Or where is the committee on this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, we are going to do this again. And we just really love building these relationships and partnerships with different local organizations. And so we are working again with the school district. We're going to connect to with our public art committee. Hopefully we'll see if we can get a full page this time in our recreation guide to do another student-run contest.
Well, I'm pushing for the cover. Margo, thank you so much. It was great speaking with you. And thanks for having a project like this where it involves arts and our students.
Thank you so much, Lillian.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Margo Mullen, a community services coordinator for the city of Yucaipa. And the contest they were talking about, Lillian also spoke with the winner of the contest, Sage Foy, a student at Parkview Middle School.
I first started, like, I learned about it because my neighbor said that I should enter it. I've been painting before recently, and I just started painting a lot in quarantine, so she thought that it was a good idea for me to enter. I found out about it through the Yucaipa Instagram, and so I looked into it, and it was about painting your favorite nature scene in Yucaipa. So my favorite nature scene in Yucaipa was the Oakland Nature Preserve, and I go there a lot with my family, so I just started painting, and that's how I got involved with it.
So when you decided to paint this image, were you looking at it, or did you take a picture of it, or was it kind of stuck in your head and so you had a good vision, or were you painting it out there in the open?
When I went there before, I took a picture of it, and I was going off of that picture that I had taken.
And how long did it take you to paint it?
And it took me about 3 days, and I painted about 5 hours a day.
So you heard about it on the Instagram, and then you followed up and submitted your artwork. So it wasn't a class project or anything like that. It was just you as Sage living in the city of Yucaipa.
Yes.
What made you choose that place? Have you been a resident of Yucaipa long?
Yeah, I've lived here my whole life, and I go hiking there a lot with my family, and I love the nature and all of the natural beauty there. So I really wanted to paint that and just show the natural flowers and all of what it has to offer.
You said you've been painting for a while, but you started painting more because of the pandemic and being home more, I'm assuming. What do you typically like to paint?
I paint nature scenes. That's my favorite thing to paint. I just think that they're so beautiful, and that's really the best thing that I paint.
And the items that you choose nature-wise, are they things that you've seen in person, or are they things from a book or places you visit? How do you choose the nature scenes that you choose?
It's all different, but a lot of it is stuff that I see. I'll see pretty flowers, and then I'll just choose to paint them. And I also like to incorporate a lot of butterflies.
When you learned that you had been selected as the winner, what did you think? How did you feel?
I was very excited, and I thought that this would open a lot of new opportunities for me as a painter.
And has it?
Yes, definitely.
Like what?
I got to meet the mayor and go to a council meeting, and now I'm being interviewed on the radio, so this is really awesome.
Okay, well, very cool. So what's next on your canvas? What are you going to be painting next?
I actually started painting something. It's a beautiful snowy tree scene, and that inspired me through a picture that I saw on the internet. So I didn't actually see this in real life, but...
And what do you hope to do with your art skills? Is this something you want to continue doing in a career, or what do you think about your skills?
I hope to get more involved in it in high school. Maybe I'll join an art program to just continue my artwork. And also, I would like to get professional lessons.
Well, you do know you have Vision Quest in Yucaipa. That's an art organization there. So they could be at your fingertips. A lot of wonderful artists are involved, and it's right there in Yucaipa.
That would be awesome.
Well, Sage Foy, congratulations on winning. Have you seen the publication? Do you have a copy of it?
I have 3 copies.
Well, congratulations, and thanks for spending a few minutes with me.
Thank you so much.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez speaking with Sage Foy, a student at Parkview Middle School, who won the art contest representing one's favorite part of Yucaipa. You can see the piece in the winter-spring edition of Your Yucaipa, Community Services Guide. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Sage Foy and Margot Mullen, as well as to Matt Newton. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and Sharina Wadd. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.